You are listening to a session recorded live at the American College of Emergency Physicians Scientific Assembly, held October 5th through the 8th, 2009, in Boston, Massachusetts. Now to our session.
In the interest of time, we're going to go ahead and get started. Thank you. I want to welcome you to Scientific Assembly and sort of an opening session here, 8 o'clock on the first day. Join me in welcoming Dr. Broder. Dr. Broder is an assistant professor in the Division of Emergency Medicine in the Department of Surgery at Duke University. He comes to us from Durham, North Carolina, and this morning he'll be speaking on the use of CT in abdominal pain, critical answers to difficult questions. He does ask that these are difficult questions and sometimes difficult to see images, small findings, so please move forward or you may regret it about halfway through the talk. Dr. Broder?
Thank you. Can everyone hear me? Okay. Well, I really appreciate everybody coming out early in the morning to hear a talk on abdominal CT, and I hope to make it worth your time. This is a topic that's really very exciting to me, and we'll get right into things. Let's see. Or we'll try to get right into it. Okay. All right, so our objectives this morning. We're going to review the recent literature on the use of CT to assess abdominal pain in the emergency department and ask some critical questions. Is CT beneficial? And we know CT is very good for diagnosing a lot of different conditions, but the question is there a clinical benefit to that diagnostic power? What is the radiation impact of a CT scan, multiple CT scans, and how should that influence our utilization of CT and what we tell patients? Do you need contrast? If so, under what circumstances, for what disease processes, oral, IV, rectal contrast? We know that there are problems with the use of contrast. If we don't need contrast, how do we persuade our radiology colleagues of this? And I'm going to give you some tips from the radiology literature and, in fact, from the American College of Radiology to try to persuade your radiologists to do the right thing. And what diseases can we see without contrast? It's obviously is an important issue, particularly with regard to oral contrast, because of the time delays that occur when we're using that agent. An important risk stratification tool. How do we know which patients are at risk of contrast nephropathy, and what strategies can we use to prevent that serious injury? Finally, how sensitive is CT? What can it miss? And when is it safe to discharge a patient with a negative CT scan? I have no disclosures to make. I wish I did. Okay. So my interest in CT comes from, I guess, from nature. My mother is a human geneticist. My father is a radiologist. And we spent a lot of time looking at images when I was a child. I'm the guy with the big nose in the background there. Now, how frequently do we use abdominal CT? Obviously, it's an important modality to us. And I would wager that you all would agree with that since you're here at 8 o'clock in the morning to talk about it. I looked through the medical literature trying to find out what the rate of utilization was in the emergency department and couldn't find an answer. And so I'm currently at Duke University, but when I was an attending at University of North Carolina, I surveyed our own use over a six-year period. Now, I know the graph's a little confusing, but the tallest purple bar is head CT, and it by far leads the pack in terms of our use of CT. But the purple bar just behind is actually our use of abdominal CT. What you'll see is from the first year of our study, marching along year by year, abdominal CT utilization makes a steady climb. And by the end of that study period, which was in 2006 or 2005, over 8% of all of our emergency department visits involved the use of an abdominal CT. Now, to me, that's sort of a startling figure, but I guess we should put it in context and ask, you know, is there a reasonable number of abdominal CTs that should be ordered? What percentage of the emergency department population actually has abdominal pain? And nationally, the statistics are about 8% of emergency department visits are for abdominal pain, vomiting, some other symptom related to the abdomen. So you might ask, is this the natural cap? Have we reached the maximum number of abdominal CTs that we could perform? Well, this number includes patients with abdominal, or I should say blunt vehicular trauma, many of whom probably had no abdominal pain but had other indications to get scanned, patients with renal colic who technically probably didn't have abdominal pain, patients who had a chest CT looking for an aortic problem that tracked down into the abdomen in order to assess the abdominal aorta, So, in fact, we might reach a stage where we could CT 50% more patients than actually have abdominal pain. It's food for thought. We're going to be pretty critical of CT during this session, so I want to take a moment to actually honor CT and think about the power and wonder of this technology. It was only a little over 100 years ago that Rankin discovered X-rays. And, of course, in 1895, this is what we were driving around. One of the first X-rays taken was of Rankin's wife's hand. I think, you know, radiation dangers at the time weren't greatly appreciated. And really, plane film hasn't changed dramatically over the last 100 and so some years. Now, in 1971, Sir Godfrey Hounsfield, a British physicist, developed a prototype head CT scanner. And Hounsfield, of course, we all know the name Hounsfield from the Hounsfield unit of CT density. He was a characteristic eccentric scientist who came to the United States to help install one of the first CT scanners in the U.S. and famously refused to change from London time. So he was about 6 hours out of sync with everybody else on the team. Now, anybody know who the question mark is? There's a co-inventor or co-discoverer of CT scan who's sort of lost to history. An American, actually South African-born, named Alan Cormack, by the way that these coincidences happen in science, he actually invented a CT scanner or the physics behind it at the same time as Hounsfield, and the two were honored with the Nobel Prize later for their discoveries, although they were quite independent of one another. Anyone know what the relationship is here? 1969, so the CT scanner has not yet been invented. But this photograph, which is famed for its sort of premonitory suggestion of things to come, who are these for? They're the Beatles, of course, and it's Abbey Road. And if you look at the song list on the album, you'll know that something is about to come around the corner because the letters CT appear frequently throughout song titles. And you may not know, but EMI was the publisher for the Beatles records, and EMI made a lot of money doing that, and one of the things that EMI did with that money was fund EMI Labs, which funded Hounsfield's research. So we owe the Beatles CT. Now, you may think of CT as a non-invasive imaging modality, but the first scanners required you to section the human brain and immerse it in water in order to take pictures of it. So I think we wouldn't use CT scan as much as we do today if we still had to go through that process. Here are some images of early CT scanners. And in 1973, now, I was born in 1973. I've been an attending physician for 8 years, and I gripe as much as anyone else at how slow it is sometimes to get imaging studies done. But in 1973, first-generation CT scan took 7 minutes per slice, and the pixel resolution was only 80 by 80. And you can see the quality there, but it was still a miraculous discovery. In 1973, this is what people were driving. 1975, Alfidi and Haga published in Radiology the first description of the use of CT to image the abdomen. And it's actually interesting to read. It says, the utility of computed tomography in the study of the anatomy, physiology, and pathology of the human body has been the subject of considerable interest since the introduction of CT scanning. The advent of a new prototype scanning device has made it possible to examine a variety of abnormalities in the abdomen and thorax in a manner not previously possible. This development permits a remarkable insight into the study of human disease in vivo. And so we were then off to the races, because just a year later, the same group described use of CT to image abdominal metastases. And to put it in context, I mean, the image on the right side of the screen, it's grainy. You'll note that convention of having the patient's right side on the left side of the image has not been developed yet, so the liver is actually displayed on the right, on our right. But think about the imaging alternative at the time. The only way you could detect abdominal metastases was a nuclear medicine scan of the abdomen, which gives you the resolution you see on the left, or you could do angiography, and you could see if there was high blood flow to metastases, you might be able to identify them. But so CT really was a miracle. And just a year later, so Jimmy Carter is elected president, and shortly thereafter, the same group again reports on both the diagnosis and aspiration of abdominal abscesses now. And again, at the left side of the screen is what's called a linear tomogram, which is really the only other way of looking at soft tissues within the abdomen at the time with any kind of image resolution. And then on the right side of the screen, we see the corresponding CT scan, which shows a perinephric abscess. So just remarkable. You know, today it's 2009. CT in many hospitals already, not just in the research setting. We can do 64 slices a second. Slice thickness is sub-millimeter. The pixel resolution is 512 by 512. And I built this 3D Recon, which I admit is a bit dizzying, on my home computer with free software. So, you know, we're really at a completely different stage of technology. All right. So let's delve into some hard-hitting questions about CT. Is CT actually a good idea for the assessment of abdominal pain? There are really very few randomized controlled trials that prospectively evaluate the outcomes with the use of CT. Most studies over the past 25 years have studied on the test characteristics of CT, the sensitivity and specificity, which is really where those studies should have started. Outcomes are not really dependent just on the diagnostic quality of the test. They depend on what we do with the information, right? So you can have the best diagnostic test in the world, and if you don't know how to treat the disease once it's diagnosed, the outcome won't be affected. So we have to keep that in mind. But does early CT in non-traumatic abdominal pain actually improve outcomes? Well, I scoured the literature. In 1978, they were asking similar questions. With computed tomography and abdominal diseases, a valuable diagnostic aid? I think I was intrigued by this article. Progressive gas formation in a deceased person during mortuary storage demonstrated on computed tomography. That's from this year. That's an outcome we all hope to avoid, so I don't think it's relevant to our particular interests. But back in 2002, the British Medical Journal published a randomized controlled trial involving 125 patients with non-traumatic abdominal pain. And they compared an arm in which the patients had to undergo early CT scan within 24 hours of hospital admission versus standard care. Now, some patients in the standard care arm did get CT, but not many because it certainly wasn't in wide use in Britain at that time. And they compared length of stay, diagnostic accuracy, and then after the fact, they went back and looked at the rate of death in the two arms, although that wasn't one of their planned outcome measures. And what they demonstrated was a non-significant reduction in length of stay. So we can't say that CT reduced length of stay. In fact, it's not even intuitive that using CT early would reduce length of stay because you might actually find incidental findings which would prompt additional workups which might actually prolong the hospital length of stay. They demonstrated more accurate diagnosis of serious conditions using CT. I put a question mark here because for many of the other patients, they never had a CT scan. And it's possible that they had a lower rate of serious pathology. We really don't know because in this case, CT was part of the diagnostic standard. That's a form of bias we call incorporation bias. And so we really can't know with certainty how CT contributed to diagnosis here. And there were no deaths in the CT arm, but 11% in the standard arm without CT as a mandatory part of the workup died. So there's a suggestion, although it's certainly not proof positive, that in undifferentiated non-traumatic abdominal pain, early CT is of benefit. Now, our literature is full of studies trying to find a benefit to CT, and particularly appendicitis is probably the single most studied application of CT. And here's a study from Academic Emergency Medicine in 2003, which found that CT use is associated with a decline in the time from ED presentation to appendectomy in female patients. And it looks like an impressive difference. With CT, 433 minutes to get to the operating room and 700 minutes if you don't have a CT. There are a couple of problems with studies of this type. Now, I'm not picking on this study in particular, but one, this is an association. It's a retrospective study, and we can't actually prove that patients undergoing CT, that the CT was the reason they reached the operating room in a quicker fashion. In fact, the title is misleading because impact of helical CT really implies that there's a causative relationship, which we can't know for certain. Let's look at a few other studies. Actually, to go back for a second, the other problem here is, do we really care about the time from ED presentation to appendectomy? Well, that's a surrogate for the outcome that we're interested in, which is perforation rate, rate of negative appendectomy, and I guess length of stay in our emergency department. Because if they got to the OR a little faster, hopefully they weren't sitting in the emergency department longer. But so the study really isn't asking the question we're most interested in. And unfortunately, there are literally 10, 20, 50 studies with similar findings, each seeking to demonstrate either a positive impact of CT with a reduction in perforation rates and negative appendectomy rates, or to illustrate that CT doesn't have an impact. And they fall into both camps with similar, with equal numbers. So you can really make a case based on these retrospective studies that CT is either a benefit or not, depending on which camp you associate yourself with. Let's look at how we can be misled by some of this data. This is published in 2008. It's a statewide database from Washington State, and it looked at 15 hospitals, over 3,000 patients undergoing appendectomy between 2006 and 2007. So it's recent data. And what they found was that the perforation rate was 17% if you had imaging and only 15% without imaging, although the statistics show that these numbers are basically equivalent. Now, you could read that and at face value think, well, imaging didn't really help us because the perforation rate was similar or no different, maybe even a little worse with imaging. But remember, this isn't a randomized controlled trial. Presumably, these two populations differed in a very substantial way. And what you could imagine is if the surgeon was willing to operate without imaging, those were classic cases of appendicitis. And those who got imaged, I presume, had a wider differential diagnosis or a more occult presentation. So really what we don't know is what would have the perforation rate been if we hadn't imaged those patients. Maybe the numbers would have been 30% perforation rate in the group who did get imaged if they hadn't been imaged. So this study certainly doesn't prove that there's no benefit to CT. What we need are randomized controlled trials, of which there are a handful. This is a randomized controlled trial published in Academic Emergency Medicine 2 years ago, and it studied mandatory CT in one arm versus the selective use. Selective use is what we do every day in 152 patients. There was a trend toward better outcomes in the mandatory CT group, and we'll talk about trends and what they mean. The perforation rate was 2.5% if you got a CT, almost 14% if you didn't, or if CT was used in a selective fashion. And the negative appendectomy rate was only 10% in those who had to get a CT, almost twice that, 18%, if CT was only used selectively. So those numbers look compelling. It looks like those would be very important differences. If mandatory CT indeed cut the perforation rate to 2.5% and cut the negative appendectomy rate in half, those would be important differences. When you hear trend toward, it means they didn't reach statistical significance. And when, I think Jerry Hoffman has said numerous times on EM Abstract, so I'm quoting him without his permission, but that when there's a difference that looks important at face value but doesn't reach statistical significance, that's an underpowered study. Because if it were adequately powered, either that difference would evaporate or it would actually reach statistical significance. So this is a study that really should be repeated. Here's a second study. Also a randomized controlled trial, but it reverses the mandate. The mandate here is clinical assessment alone versus selective CT, and it demonstrated no difference. So the implication being, again, that CT wasn't of benefit, but it's a small study that's underpowered to detect differences. And a third study, again, clinical assessment alone versus a mandatory CT scan, again, did not show any differences in the important outcomes, but underpowered. So people are on the right track. They're asking the right question with the right study design, but we need to expand these studies. Let's talk about risk for a moment. We all, I think, know that there's some risk of cancer and some risk of teratogenic effect from radiation exposures. And we know this, unfortunately, from human experience with atomic bomb attacks in Japan, where citizens of those cities who were exposed to radiation levels not dissimilar from those from diagnostic CT incurred cancers. Now, I mean, there's a big difference between being near an atomic bomb when it goes off and undergoing CT scan, but at least there are some ways that we can compare these. Now, if you think that you can avoid radiation, I think you need to think again. So here's a study, of course, referenced in the New York Times, but published in the journal Nature from UCLA just this past year, demonstrating that if you peel scotch tape, it emits X-rays, and in fact, enough X-rays that you can photograph, take an X-ray of a finger using peeling of scotch tape. Now, before you panic, because I think I peeled scotch tape last night, and I wasn't wearing lead when I did it, you have to peel it in a vacuum in order for this to happen. So rest assured, you're probably not in danger. But we're all exposed to radiation every day of our life, and the background radiation for an average U.S. citizen is about 2.5 millisieverts, which is roughly a quarter of an abdominal CT. The National Commission on Radiation Protections said in 2007 that CT-based radiation exposure in the U.S. population was soaring, that radiation exposures had increased over the past decade by 600%, and much of it was from CT scanning. They called U.S. physicians oblivious to radiation exposure risk, and this was just 2 years ago. So I'll say none of you can claim to be oblivious anymore. I can tell you who else is not oblivious. I Googled radiation CT lawyer, and the first hit is injuryboard.com, a website that warns you that CAT scans, CT scans, or CAT scans expose you to radiation. And it says, see a doctor if you believe you've been exposed to excessive amounts of radiation. And then at the bottom of the screen, it says, also, be sure to contact an attorney. So we need to be aware of this for medical and medical legal reasons. In 2007, the New England Journal of Medicine published a review article entitled Computed Tomography, an Increasing Source of Radiation Exposure. It was by a physicist, not a physician, but a physicist, Brenner, who spent his entire career looking at radiation exposures from diagnostic imaging and trying to estimate the risks from those studies. And Brenner's estimate is that about 2% of U.S. cancers today may be attributable to CT. Now, the very day, I note, here's November 29, 2007, New England Journal says that the same day by 7:45 a.m., it's on the AP on the web, and it says, study, CT scans raise cancer risk. Now, this wasn't a study. This was a review article where Brenner took a previous estimate and plugged in current numbers of CT scans being performed, also an estimate of that, and got an estimate of potential cancer induction. So it's certainly not a study, but that doesn't keep the AP from captioning the picture. Millions of Americans, especially children, are needlessly getting dangerous radiation from super X-rays that raise the risk of cancer and increasingly are used to diagnose medical problems, a new report warns. Just a couple of weeks ago, August 27, 2009, this is a study, New England Journal of Medicine, documenting in almost a million patients a population-based study, fairly high rates of radiation exposures, although there's a wide range. As you can imagine, some patients with serious conditions get imaged at multiple times during their hospital stays. Now, we probably would be more circumspect about our own utilization of CT if we were like this early physician. He's using an unshielded X-ray tube to take a chest X-ray of this patient. He's standing only a few feet away, so early practitioners got high radiation exposures just from using diagnostic imaging. I love this photograph because it looks to me like Albert Einstein is taking an X-ray of Arnold Schwarzenegger. All right. So now, in order to put the radiation risk from CT or other diagnostic imaging into perspective, we have to know what is the baseline risk of fatal cancer. In the United States, what percentage of the population dies of cancer? Is it 1 in 100? Is it 1 in 50? 1 in 10? Well, it's the second leading cause of death in the United States. According to the latest data, now it's from 2005, it was just published in 2008, but it takes them a little while apparently to the CDC needs faster computers. Seems to me that it shouldn't take them 3 years to publish this. But in any case, 22.8% of U.S. deaths in 2005 were from cancer. So your lifetime risk of cancer in the United States is around 1 in 5, a little more than 1 in 5. Okay. With that as the background, here's what Brenner estimates. These lines show organ-specific rates of cancer deaths, and we're going to ignore them for a moment and concentrate on the black line. The black line shows you, at any given age, if you underwent a CT, what additional risk of cancer you would incur through the course of your lifetime. And before you try to look at the numbers, you know, if you get CT'd at birth, there's a higher risk than if you're 75 years old or 80 years old, for multiple reasons. Children are more biologically sensitive, they're growing quickly, cells reproduce quickly, a mutation becomes propagated more quickly in that scenario, and they've got a whole lifetime ahead of them, many years for any incurred radiation-induced mutation to manifest as a cancer. If you're 65 years old and you have a mutation that will ultimately lead to cancer, you probably will die from something else before that manifests. So now, what's the scale of these? This is not percent. This is fractions of 1%. So Brenner's estimate is that at birth, if you underwent an abdominal CT scan, you'd incur an additional risk of 0.14%, 14 hundredths of 1%, or about 1/700. And the risk declines to about 1 in 1,000 by early childhood, 1 in 2,000 by the teen years, and by adulthood, say 35 and beyond, you're in the range of an additional 1 in 5,000 risk. And again, to reflect on the rate compared with the baseline risk, your risk of death from cancer is about 22.8%, and you add 0.14% from a CT at birth and 0.02% from a CT at age 35. So frankly, why the fuss? And I want to explain the fuss because I'm a radiation hawk. I think we have to be careful about this. But from an individual patient perspective, these are very tiny risks incurred with a single CT scan. This is the risk of death, and we care about cancers that don't lead to death. Cancer is painful, cancer is scary, cancer is expensive, cancer ruins people's quality of life. So it's not just deaths that matter. In addition, we care about when cancers occur. So if you increase your risk of cancer because of an early CT and you die of cancer at age 30, there's a lot more life years lost and quality of life lost and sorrow that goes on with the death of a 30-year-old from cancer or a child from cancer than if someone dies at a very advanced age. So there are other issues besides the fact that mortality will occur. But what this means is that on a population level, CT in millions of patients, which is what's happening in the United States, probably is resulting in a finite and measurable number of increased cancers. But you probably shouldn't be telling your individual patient, you're about to get cancer from the CT you're undergoing, because look at the risk compared with the baseline risk of cancer. Now, I want to dispel another myth about radiation, and that is I hear a lot of people talking about that's the amount of radiation that you're allowed to have, or that's the amount of radiation that causes cancer. And those really are misstatements. The National Academy of Sciences publishes a report. Every few years they update it. It's called Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation. And the model that they've adopted is called the Linear No Threshold Model. Now, what does that mean? No threshold means there's no threshold for cancer induction. Every photon we're exposed to of ionizing radiation carries some risk, like a spin of a roulette wheel, that it's going to cause a base pair injury that could lead to cancer. And if you were to think about the roulette wheel analogy, how many free spins can you get on a roulette wheel that would guarantee that you wouldn't win? Well, you might win on the first spin of the roulette wheel. It's unlikely, but it could happen. And how many spins of the roulette wheel are required to guarantee that you'll win? Well, there's no guaranteed number. You could spin it a million times and be really unlucky and never win, but you probably will win. The more times you spin, the higher the risk, and that's really what this model says. So when somebody says CTs give you a radiation exposure that's high enough to cause cancer, well, scotch tape gives you high enough to increase your risk of cancer, but by a very marginal amount. So again, we need to avoid using terminology that I think is misleading. And the problem is our patients don't get one CT scan. This is a study I did at University of North Carolina showing that among renal colic patients, about 20% had had one or fewer CT scans in our database. 80% of them had had two or more CTs, and 10% of them had had five or more. And since there's a cumulative effect of these exposures, it's not the one CT that's going to do you in, it's the multitude of CTs you'll get. All right. And here's the numbers. Yellow is CT of the abdomen, so there was a 100% increase in use over a five-year period in my study. How many chest x-rays equal one CT? It's about 500, although I'll caution you that CT radiologists are getting better about CT. They're reducing the radiation exposures, at least in the research setting. And part of the problem we face today is the protocols for reducing radiation exposure that are used in the research setting aren't being implemented in our hospitals. And so we need to see those improvements in technology being used in our emergency departments. All right. And just again to estimate, we're about to finish up. I think we're beating a dead horse here with cancer risk, but it's an important topic. How many cancers would you cause in your career with your use of CT? Well, let's say that you do 2 CT scans per shift. Maybe that's an underestimate. And 12 shifts per month. Okay, I work a cushy academic job, so I'm allowed to say that. But 144 shifts a year, that's over 4,000 shifts in 30 years. And again, it depends. If you were CTing neonates, which I don't think we do very often, you'd induce more cancers. But if you're CTing adults, you'd probably be causing, of course you couldn't identify the patients you'd cause the cancers in, but about 4 fatal cancers over that time period. And again, are we aware of this risk? Well, you're all aware of the risk. But back in 2004, a survey of radiologists, patients, and emergency physicians asking whether there was any cancer risk associated with CT use, the answer was basically an emphatic no. Only 9% of emergency physicians in 2004 knew that radiation and CT might and cancer might be related. And sort of shamefully, only 47% of radiologists, this is their field, less than half of them at that time made any link between CT and cancer. And patients, of course, lag behind because we're the ones who tell them about the risk, and if we don't know, how would they know? All right. A final slide on radiation. Does it cause fetal mutations? Well, sure, radiation causes fetal mutations at some level. But here's a study, again, just asking family practitioners and obstetricians, do you think that an abdominal X-ray or an abdominal CT scan gives greater than a 5% chance of a fetal malformation? Now, the answer to this question is no, neither study gives a greater than 5% chance of inducing a fetal malformation. Yet, 44% of family practitioners thought an abdominal X-ray caused fetal mutations at greater than 5% rate. 61% blamed a CT, and the OBs were not a whole lot dissimilar from that. And the numbers in parentheses are how many would have recommended an abortion to a patient following a single diagnostic imaging study. So we both under and overestimate radiation risks, and I think that's a lot of education has to go on. All right. We're going to move quickly through the rest of the talk. A lot of practical things I hope you can use in your emergency department. What's the size and weight limit? I work at a tertiary care place. We get patients transferred to us. You may have either received a patient if you work at a large center, or you may have transferred a patient to get a CT scan because your scanner wouldn't accommodate the patient. So, well, the numbers are the weight limit from all major manufacturers tops out at about 650 pounds if you buy their extra large version of the scanner. And the limiting factor is actually the gantry diameter, okay, because they make the standard CT gantry is only 70 centimeters in diameter, and if your abdominal girth is too great, you won't fit through the hole. There are large versions that accommodate up to 90 centimeters. Now, I know what you're going to say. What can I just go, so I'll send the patient to the North Carolina Zoo, or I'll send them to the North Carolina School of Veterinary Medicine, and surely their scanner will accommodate the patient. Well, I think this is a myth. I emailed Ian Robertson, who's the head of radiology at the North Carolina State University Veterinary School, and he told me they've got a Siemens Sensation 16 slice scanner. It's a human scanner. It has a table that they've adapted to allow them to put equine limbs in through the hole, but the hole isn't any bigger, and you can't just drill a bigger hole through the CT scanner for a larger patient, and there's no money in veterinary CT, so you're not going to find a CT scanner that can scan an elephant. And if I'd be happy to entertain anybody who's had an experience where they can, but he also said that they're not licensed to take care of human patients, so they would not scan a human being. Here's a website. You can look it up. It's rtimage.com, and they import the data from major manufacturers. So I picked 4 just for fairness, and all of them, the 90-centimeter bore, in fairness, is their large model. And again, here's the patient weight limit, 500, 450, 500, 600 pounds. Okay. Let's talk about contrast. When do we need contrast? Well, first, we have to understand a little bit about what the theoretical benefit of contrast might be, and then let's see if it bears out in actual clinical practice. Now, we know that PO contrast is a problem. PO contrast means time. Time in the department is risk, and it might not be the patient who's drinking the contrast who's at risk. It might be the person who's in the waiting room waiting for the room who's dying of something. IV contrast is risk. IV contrast is risk of allergy, risk of contrast nephropathy. So CT and contrast, we need to understand how CT works. CT is all about density, and I like to use the analogy of a glass filled with water, and I apologize for kind of a goofy graphic, but if we have a glass full of water, the water is dense, air sits on top of the water. If we drop a bone into the glass, it's going to sink to the bottom because it's densest. And if we drop in a hot dog or a piece of soft tissue, it's actually going to sink toward the bottom because it's less dense than the bone, but it's more dense than the water. And if you poured cooking oil into the glass, it's going to float on the top because oil is less dense than water, but it's certainly more dense than air. And so this is exactly what we have on CT, that the least dense is air, followed by fat, fluids, including water and blood, then soft tissue, and then bone. And so if we look at the Hounsfield CT scale, by definition, a Hounsfield value of zero is water. It's right in the middle of the scale. The least dense substance has a value of minus 1,000 in its air, and the densest of dense bone is plus 1,000. And fat is less dense than water, so it's minus 50. And then it turns out, unfortunately for us, that muscle, liver, kidney, blood, most soft tissues and fluids in the body are similar in density around plus 40. You can adjust the window level to spread our grayscale out in different ways to accentuate different tissues. Basically, what we're doing is the human eye can only perceive certain differences in grayscales, and if we stretch them out over the entire range, we're not going to be able to differentiate between two tissues of similar but slightly different density. We can cone down that grayscale to focus on a particular organ system like bone or vascular, and then we can differentiate more subtle differences in density by adjusting the grayscale. Okay, so and here are examples. I'm sure you've seen all of this, a bone window, a soft tissue window, and a lung window, and I'll show you how you can use those diagnostically to your advantage. So let's look at tissue densities. Here's a non-contrast abdominal CT, and I've labeled some of the tissues just to point them out. Air is black. Okay, fluid, here is the aorta filled with no contrast, just blood on a typical abdominal window, and it's got an intermediate gray color. Here is the inferior vena cava, the renal vein. They have a similar color. But you'll note that on a non-contrast CT, they're awfully similar to the soft tissue of the liver. Here's the kidney and simple fluid in a renal cyst. So, and if you think about it, blood is slightly more dense than water because about 45% of blood is red cells, right? So it's basically blood is either a viscous liquid or a really low-density solid, depending on how you want to think about it. Fat is a natural contrast agent, and fortunately, everybody's got fat. I hate to tell you, but here's subcutaneous fat. Fat on an abdominal window normally looks almost black. It's sort of a speckled, dark gray shade. Here's retroperitoneal fat. Now, what would we do if there weren't fat here? The liver would abut the kidney. The kidney would abut the psoas muscle, and I would not be able to distinguish where one began and the next and the other ended because they share essentially the same density. So fat is our friend. Fat, we know this from childhood. Everybody knows Fat Albert is our friend. Fat is our friend on CT, at least within limits. It acts as a contrast medium between adjacent organs, and it provides the substrate for fat stranding. Fat stranding, how many people have heard of fat stranding? So you know it from your reports. Perhaps you know it when you see it. What fat stranding looks like, and we'll show an example, is a graying or a smoky appearance of that fat. And why is that? Well, stranding is lymphatic leak into inflamed fat. Water leaking into fat tissues. Water is denser than fat. As it increases the density of the fat, it appears brighter on CT with no contrast agents, just the water that's being added to the fat. Okay, so when might we need exogenous contrast agents? Well, if there's really almost no fat present, at least in theory, we might need contrast. When contiguous tissues of interest are they're touching each other, they have the same density, we need something to tell us where one ends and the other begins. And theoretically, vascular, infectious, and inflammatory conditions because of high blood flow, if you throw IV contrast in that patient, those conditions are going to light up on the CT scan because of blood flow. oral contrast, by filling up the bowel, you'll be able to tell. Now, normally bowel is fluid density. It's filled with fluid. If there's an abscess lying immediately adjacent to bowel, it might be difficult to distinguish that fluid-filled abscess cavity from just a loop of fluid-filled bowel. So the theoretical benefit of oral contrast is fill up the bowel. Now we know where the bowel is, and anything that's not bowel will stand out. Okay, that's the theory. Again, here's fat acting as a contrast agent. When you're trying to figure out if it's normal fat or inflamed fat, pick an area of natural control. So pick an area of subcutaneous fat and compare it to fat within the abdomen and see if they look the same. If they look, if it looks whiter within the abdomen, it's probably an area of fat stranding. Some patients have a lot of fat. This patient has appendicitis, and look at the fat around. This is the cecum. This is fat surrounding that region. And this patient has not received IV contrast. Look at the vessels. No IV contrast. Yes, they got some oral contrast, but the fat stranding was enough. Okay. Now, some patients don't have much fat. And if you don't have much fat, look at the pelvis with no contrast agents added. It is pretty difficult to tell where loops of bowel begin and end, where other organs like the ovaries might exist. So there are some reasons to think some patients need contrast. And I say this because I look at listserv sort of back and forth, and I see a lot of people saying that never is contrast needed. And I think there are many, many times when contrast is not needed, but we need to be smart enough to know when it might be necessary. Okay. Enhancement with IV contrast is an increase in attenuation because the contrast is going where blood flow is going. And so an inflamed appendix here lights up, the wall lights up because it's inflamed. Okay. Now, so do we need oral contrast? We're going to talk about whether we need it, but should we care? I mean, does it really delay our patient care by that much? Well, here's a study, not a randomized controlled trial. It simply compared time in the emergency department if you got a non-contrast CT or you got a CT with oral contrast. And there was a big difference in the time, but of course we order those two different kinds of scans in very different patients. So I don't think you can look at the total numbers. The difference in time, though, from when the scan was ordered until when it was accomplished, that probably reflects the time needed to consume oral contrast. Okay? And in this study, there was a difference of about an hour, 72 minutes or so, 70 minutes or so for oral contrast. So certainly there's a delay. Here's another study recently published in Annals of Emergency Medicine. Now, the point of this study was to say, well, what if we give some antiemetics before we give the oral contrast? Will that speed things up? And from that perspective, this was a negative study. It compared, in a randomized controlled fashion, placebo to metoclopramide or ondansetron, and there was no difference in the length of time that it took for patients to consume oral contrast. Now, by the way, this was prophylactically. This wasn't because they were vomiting. This was before they even started drinking the contrast. So I'm not saying not to give an antiemetic to a vomiting patient. But look at the times required. In every case, the 50th percentile was 110 minutes, almost 2 hours to consume oral contrast. So I think you go to your radiologist and say, you know, this is a pretty long delay for patient care. What about risk of contrast nephropathy? Well, let's define it for a second. Contrast nephropathy is a rise of 25% from baseline creatinine or 0.5 milligrams per deciliter from the starting value. It occurs frequently. 15% of contrast procedures results in contrast nephropathy, and that's 150 cases per year in the U.S., accounting for 10% of in-hospital renal failure. So it's a big deal. And creatinine clearance is an accepted, the accepted threshold for risk is at 60 mils per minute. Now, here's the problem. How many people in the room think about creatinine clearance when they're thinking about patients? I admit I do not. Okay. We think in terms of measured serum creatinine. And so the question is, does using the measured serum creatinine actually help us to identify the patients who are about to be at serious risk from contrast? Well, here's a study. 700 ED patients, almost 800, 100 of whom had low creatinine clearance, so they're at risk. Could you pick them out from the crowd by using a serum creatinine cutoff? I'll give you a choice. Which serum creatinine would you use? Which do you use in reality? Do you say, does your radiologist, or do you say 1.8 is the highest creatinine will allow, 1.5, 1.2, or 1? Well, here's what the study showed. If you used a creatinine of 1.5, 40% of the people who had seriously decreased renal function and therefore high risk had creatinine clearances or creatinines measured lower than 1.5. So they're in an at-risk group. It's easy to calculate. You can Google or web search for creatinine clearance calculator, plug in the patient's age and their mass, which are the two biggest determinants in addition to their measured serum creatinine of what their real creatinine clearance is. Our lab actually reports it now automatically calculated, but I'd encourage you to start using that. Because an 85-year-old female who weighs only 60 kilograms and has a creatinine of 1 is at risk. She's got a creatinine lower or creatinine clearance below the threshold. Quick note on preventing contrast nephropathy. There was a lot of hype and interest in agents to block contrast nephropathy, ranging from N-acetylcysteine to sodium bicarbonate. The latest studies, though, are not very promising. The initial study, which was done at Carolina's Medical Center, comparing sodium bicarb, showed a benefit, but had some methodological problems. That was this single study. The latest RCT, randomized controlled trial, showed no difference between normal saline and sodium bicarb. Now, we know normal saline works. So if you have to give IV contrast, you know, give as much normal saline before and after as the patient will tolerate. All right. We're running through some. Do you need oral contrast in trauma? How many groups use oral contrast for trauma? Almost nobody. Great. I'm glad to hear it. We've known for over 10 years that there's no apparent benefit. That doesn't mean there's zero benefit. It means that bowel injuries, which is what we would hope to detect with oral contrast, are quite rare. And so if they occur in less than 1% of trauma patients, you'd have to do an enormous study to demonstrate a difference, even a large difference, between use of oral contrast and not. So there might be a benefit, but you'd have to CT so many patients with oral contrast to find one additional injury that from a practical perspective, we shouldn't use it. Okay. Is oral contrast needed for appendicitis? Well, a meta-analysis of 23 studies showed no difference between CT without oral contrast and CT with oral contrast. Here's the pooled sensitivity without contrast, 95%. When you give oral contrast, it ironically was 92%. So it looked lower, but statistically they were identical. Specificity, 97% without any oral contrast, 92% with oral contrast. So there certainly is no basis for giving oral contrast from this meta-analysis. Hot off the presses, this is Annals of Emergency Medicine, so new it's only out electronically. They haven't even put a volume or month on it yet. A meta-analysis, actually a systematic review, and when they pulled the high-quality studies, non-contrast CT has a sensitivity around 92-93% and a specificity of 96%. And you may be familiar with likelihood ratios. Likelihood ratios help us to go from pre-test probability to post-test probability. A likelihood ratio greater than 10 is considered strong proof of the presence of disease, and the likelihood ratio here is 24. So if your non-contrast, zero IV, zero oral contrast shows appendicitis, you've got a 24-fold increased likelihood of having appendicitis. And if it's negative, it's got a likelihood ratio of 0.08. And a likelihood ratio less than 0.1 is considered strong negative proof for a disease process. So it looks like unenhanced CT is very powerful. Now, where is Waldo? Well, for radiologists, seeking out the appendix is like looking for Waldo. And they hunt and hunt and hunt, and they should know to look in the right lower quadrant because that's where Waldo is, and just like the appendix. And are there ways to improve visualization of the appendix? And so does IV contrast improve visualization of the normal appendix? Well, a study, the good news is this is from radiology literature. In order to convince radiologists, we're going to need to reference their own core journals. Here's a study from last year looking at IV contrast, and it did not alter the rate of identification of the normal appendix. And they did note that if the patient had an increased BMI or increased abdominal fat, it increased the rate of identification, which we'd expect from our comments about fat as a contrast agent. Okay. And that was from American Journal of Rankinology, 2008. Okay. What if you don't see the appendix? This is a problem for us. We always get reports where the radiologist says, well, I don't see any stranding, I don't see any fluid, I don't see any inflammatory changes, but I can't find the appendix. Does that exclude appendicitis? That's an important question. Well, fortunately, multiple large studies, American Journal of Rankinology, Radiology, looking at both adults and children, showing that if there are no other inflammatory changes noted, if the appendix isn't seen, there's basically a 98 or 99% chance that that patient does not have appendicitis. So from our perspective, in fact, in this last study, there was no difference whether they saw the appendix completely, saw part of it, or didn't see it in terms of the rate of negative tests for appendicitis. So we don't have to see the appendix. Now, can we extrapolate? We know that from the data I've shown you that CT probably doesn't require contrast to identify appendicitis. Appendicitis is a lot like diverticulitis. It's a problem of inflammation of a diverticulum of bowel. I mean, the appendix is just a long diverticulum, essentially. So does the same thing hold true? Well, here's a study looking at a reduced radiation dose. Now, this is pretty important. When you reduce the radiation dose, you end up with a higher signal-to-noise ratio. And over the years, radiologists started out, they're essentially photographers. My dad says that all the time. He's a radiologist. Radiologists are photographers. They want a beautiful image. But we don't necessarily need a beautiful image to make the diagnosis. And so the original CT protocols were aimed at the crispest, sharpest, most detailed image. Now we're in an era of a race to the bottom. How low can you go with radiation dose and still have a diagnostic quality image? So this study actually used a very low radiation dose and then compared, on top of that, IV contrast or no IV contrast for diverticulitis, and no patient in this study received oral contrast. So here's a bowel problem. We're seeking the diagnosis. No oral contrast. Do we need IV contrast or not? And it's published in Radiology. So it's the core journal for radiologists. And what they found was no difference, equivalent high 90% sensitivity and specificity using non-contrast CT. And this is very promising. This is, 75% reduction in radiation dose from a standard CT. This is the non-contrast CT with stranding occurring in fat. And here's a contrast CT. Here's IV contrast in vessels. Okay. Do we need contrast for small bowel obstruction? It's another bowel problem. You might think contrast is needed. But we know we don't need contrast because we know from plain film findings that air fluid levels and dilated loops of bowel are visible because air is an excellent contrast agent and fluid in bowel is an excellent contrast agent. And that's what the studies show. On plain film, air fluid levels, dilated loops with low sensitivity, though. On CT scan, you're going to look for the same findings, dilated loops of bowel, air fluid levels, and a transition point. The transition point is where that adhesive band or stricture or mass is preventing the bowel from or fluid from getting past. It's the point of obstruction. Below that point or beyond that point, the bowel is no longer dilated. So CT is thought to be around 85% sensitive and no oral contrast is needed. Now, do you need, I'll just point out the findings. Here's an axial CT. This patient has no oral contrast. Dark fluid. Why is there fluid in the bowel? It's a small bowel obstruction. There's digested food, there's swallowed saliva, there's intestinal secretions, fluid that fills the bowel and acts as a negative contrast agent. It's dark rather than bright, but it easily shows us, and the threshold is 3 centimeters to identify a dilated loop of bowel on CT scan. Okay. Here's a coronal reconstruction. You get the same picture. This looks like an upright abdominal film, but remember, the patient is supine, so you don't see any air fluid levels on a coronal view of the abdomen. And finally, here's a sagittal reconstruction. You see those air fluid levels again in dilated loops of bowel. Okay. Do you need an IV contrast for small bowel obstruction? Well, prior studies show that you don't need oral contrast. Here's a study comparing no contrast of any kind with IV contrast and found no difference. Sensitivities in the mid to high 80s, specificities mid to high 80s, regardless of the use of contrast. So I'll quickly whip through these last ones because I want to finish with some documents from the American College of Radiology to help you. So contrast is not needed for free air. We all are aware that free air can sometimes be seen on chest x-ray, but chest x-ray is only thought to be about 33% sensitive. We talk about ruling out free air with a chest x-ray, but in comparison to CT, it's highly insensitive. Here's a very subtle case of free air. You probably can't see it from the back of the room. If I blow it up bigger, you can see there's a little air under the diaphragm. Here's the CT. Now, you don't need contrast of any kind because air is black. It's so much less dense than every other tissue in the body that it readily stands out. If you set the CT windows to lung windows, everything else looks very white, and air, even a little dollop of air, a little speck of air, will look black by comparison and be readily picked out. So lung windows are good for looking for air. Okay. I'll just summarize with saying that for pancreatitis, we can actually find the normal pancreas on a non-contrast CT. This is a normal pancreas. It's got this sort of crenellated appearance. The fat around it, though, is very black, and there's a crisp distinction between the edge of the pancreas. Okay. Here's a non-contrast CT with fat stranding, and you can start to see that you've lost that delineation between the pancreas and the fat. And here is hemorrhagic pancreatitis, where fluid and fat have fluid has completely obliterated the fat planes. All right, skip a couple things. For the sake of time, I'm going to skip ahead to some final things. So the American College of Radiology publishes appropriateness criteria. They're very similar to ACEP's clinical policies. Appropriateness criteria, clinical policies, they're basically expert consensus opinion with a reference list telling you what the ACR's experts think about the use of various imaging modalities. Here's their web page. So you can just Google American College of Radiology and look up appropriateness criteria, and then you find one of these links. Here's, you know, right lower quadrant abdominal pain, small bowel obstruction. Here's what they think. Suspected small bowel obstruction, their highest rating is CT without oral contrast. In fact, they specifically say that positive contrast in the bowel can obscure the etiology of the obstruction and hide enhancement of the lumen with IV contrast, of the mucosa, I should say. So you can go to your radiologist if they think that oral contrast is needed. You can say, the American College of Radiology says we don't need oral contrast. It's posted right on your webpage. Here's what they say about right lower quadrant pain. Use of oral or rectal contrast depends on institutional preference, which frankly is code words for we have no proof that oral contrast is of any benefit. Because if it were proven to be a benefit, why would they say that it's an institutional preference? And I've shown you the other studies that show you don't need it, but this is on their own website. Here's what they say about pancreatitis. Now, we can argue a lot about whether you need contrast or whether you need a CT for pancreatitis because there's really not a great mortality benefit demonstrated to identifying severe pancreatitis on CT. But CT with or without contrast, they get the same appropriateness rating from the ACR for pancreatitis. So certainly, now I should add that in order to see areas of pancreatic necrosis, ideally you give IV contrast because dead pancreas doesn't light up with IV contrast. But whether that helps the patient in any way is unproven. Is there any role left for oral contrast? A fun case, 37-year-old male. He's Spanish-speaking. I don't know what country he was from because I didn't see this patient. Several months of abdominal pain, but acutely worse, and perhaps right lower quadrant pain. And here's his CT, oral contrast. What's this? What's this? These are worms, Ascaris lumbricoides, okay? And it shows up as a filling defect. We probably would not have seen that on CT without oral contrast. Is it an important diagnosis? Well, it's one of the leading parasitic infections in the world. Over a billion people every day are infected with Ascaris. That's the prevalence of Ascaris. Does it cause severe problems? It can cause bowel obstruction. It can climb into your biliary tract. It can climb into your appendix. So, sure, depending on your practice setting, it might actually be an important diagnosis. But obviously, that's not something you have to suspect it based on the history. Is there a role for IV contrast? And maybe this is the most important point. I've emphasized that for many conditions, you don't need IV contrast. But there are some fatal conditions where IV contrast is essential. So you need to know your differential diagnosis and know when the non-contrast CT is not enough. Here's a 35-year-old male with no medical problems this month in my emergency department. Right upper quadrant pain, a white count of 25,000, so something might be up. Normal LFTs and a negative right upper quadrant ultrasound. Interestingly, it's got a bicarb of 13, an anion gap of 20, and a glucose in the 250s. He's never carried a diagnosis of diabetes. Maybe it's DKA. He has an elevated lactate, though. Now, I'm showing you two CT scans, same patient, a few hours apart. He came in and had a non-contrast CT, which was read as negative. I paired the images. Here's an IV and oral. He probably should not have gotten oral contrast, but probably did not need oral contrast. IV contrast in the aorta, and let's watch here for a second. This is the superior mesenteric artery leaving the aorta, and watch here. Okay, there's contrast in the SMA. There's something that doesn't look like contrast in the SMA. Over here, you can't tell because there's no contrast. This is the portal vein. That's the portal vein. There's something in the SMA that's blocking contrast. Again. And here, on a non-contrast CT, the SMA, superior mesenteric artery, and two branches of the portal vein, they look like Mickey Mouse's head, but you can't tell them apart because there's no contrast. Here, you can tell there's contrast in the portal vein, but not in the SMA. This patient has a near-complete occlusion of the SMA. On this sagittal reconstruction, you can see it filling the SMA. And sadly, this patient lost his entire small bowel. He's TPN-dependent for life at 35. Now, that's not a common, it's obviously a rare condition. I'm just warning you, know that a non-contrast CT doesn't show us everything. If we're thinking vascular, IV contrast is needed. Okay. I think I'm winding up. We're right on 9 o'clock. I think that's supposed to be the end of our session. I'm happy to take questions. And if you have any questions at the end, my email address is joshua.broder@duke.edu.
Thank you for listening. This concludes this session.